All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuckadelics, what the fucking avians, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my show, WTF. Welcome to it. How are you? Today on the show, Joseph Arthur, the musician, songwriter, and painter, and artist, and of all things. I don't know where I met Joseph, but I think I got a record of his from somewhere. He did this tribute record to Lou Reed that I really liked. You know, and then I listened to some of his other music and I was like, this is interesting. And then somehow we were in touch with each other on Twitter or something. I didn't really know who he was, but like he was a fan of this show and I became a fan of his music. And it was a great, great conversation. I just liked the guy. And I like his work and he does his own thing. And he's been out there a long time. And it was a surprise. Also on the show today, Peter Biebergall. He wrote a book called Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. And I just kept looking at the book. I got a lot of books. I kept seeing it sitting over there. So, you know, that's all. I'm going to do a little one with him and then Joe Arthur. So it's kind of a nice Monday Labor Day show. Okay? So you relax. You relax, you people. Look, I talked to you the other day about this opportunity I got to be on this television show on Netflix called Glow, a starring role. And I'm excited about it. There's no reason I shouldn't be excited about it. But there's some part of me that underplays a lot of things. And also, like, it wasn't easy for me to cancel shows. I don't like to cancel shows. It bothers me. I don't like to be disappointed. Why would I think anyone else would like to be disappointed? I don't expect that you'll be horrendously angry at me. I did reschedule all the shows, but there was part of me. This is an interesting thing. I'm trying to explore this because I want to stay honest around this shit so I can share it with you. Just about what I'm going through and maybe somebody can relate to it. Like, for instance, I did not feel good canceling shows. I made sure we did not cancel any of them outright and we rescheduled them all. I'm sorry if the time frame didn't work for some of you, but, and I also understand again that I would be disappointed as well. But it was not an easy decision. I knew I had to take the role because that's a once in a lifetime thing. And as far as I know, I only got one lifetime and I'm very excited about it. But I do know that I had to make a decision that would disappoint some people. But it wasn't easy. It was easy to the degree that I knew what I had to do, but that doesn't make it easy sitting inside of me. A couple people were disappointed. I saw that on Twitter. Understand that. Then there were these two people who sent emails through the site. One was crazy, just like, fuck you. I'm done with you. You know, I was looking forward to seeing you. Now you're just, I thought you were better. And now you're just a narcissistic ass. You always were. And I'm done with you. I'm erasing you from my mind and life and blah, blah. Just like, just an attack. Now, clearly, those were some deeper issues at play. But it did hit that one part of me. That part of me that's sort of like, oh, see, I upset somebody. Yeah, even though in my mind, I know, like, no one should be that upset. And, you know, I can live without her if that's her decision. That, you know, to be like, you know, fuck you, I'm done. Okay. There's nothing I can do about it. It's hard for me to hold that boundary, to have that detachment, even with this kind of shit. Maybe I'm too sensitive. That's why I guess I shouldn't be that sensitive. But the point being, then there was another email from home. These are the only two that were really the only two emails about this. And this other woman, she just went on and on about how much she admired me, how great it was, and you know how much she's been loyal to me as a fan and like very impressed with me. And then at the end, you know, because I made this decision to take a lead role in a television show that was something I really wanted to do and could change my life, and it was an exciting opportunity, once in a lifetime. Because I did that, now whatever feeling she has about me, which leading up to this were very grand and nice and supportive, will be permanently tainted like a drop of Clorox in good coffee, she said. you know, again, those are her issues. I don't have to. But my point is, it triggered the part of me that felt bad for canceling. And then I was like, oh, God damn them. Why, you know, why would they be like this? And then I realized, like, it's deeper than that. You know, no matter what your decision, you kind of want your parents to go like, it's okay, baby. It's a good decision. You know, you're doing the right thing. It's okay. Good for you. And even when you make a shitty decision, you want people to go like, yeah, that was terrible. And you know, I would be mad, but I'm not. You just want this weird, unconditional support and love. And that's just not the way life works. But I, you know, I realize that myself, that I fight with that, that, you know, and that's just something you got to accept. Sometimes you got to make these decisions. And God knows there was no one's life hanging in the balance. But some people are going to be disappointed. They didn't need to be abusive. You know, and I'm sort of an easy mark sometimes. And it's weird to have a personality that is sort of as seemingly aggressive as mine and somewhat defined in that way that, you know, I would be, you know, I don't know if it's people pleasing, but I certainly am pretty diplomatic and I'd rather there not be trouble, if that's possible. Could there not be trouble? And look, I again, I'm sorry I had to reschedule. But I had to reschedule. It's just, life is like that sometimes. And I know as many of you who have been with me a long time and are my fans who are excited about my success, I think there's a few people out there that are excited about it, but somehow feel abandoned. I'm not going anywhere. And there's still some part of me inside that is definitely not succeeding. Does that make you feel better? See how diplomatic I am? There's something inside of me that will never be successful. Does that help? Does that help? So here's how Peter Biebergall got on the show, kind of. He sent me his book. I think we were in touch on email, and he thought I'd really like the book. It was called Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. And I liked the cover. I had it in hardback sitting around, then I had it in paperback sitting around. And then finally, I took a look at it, and it was sort of a memoir slash kind of basic investigation into the mystical, kind of witchy elements of rock and roll. But it was also a lot about Peter himself. And I liked the guy. And then he happened to be coming to L.A. So I said, all right, let's do it. Come over. So this is me and Peter having a little chat about his book, Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll.
Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer, and I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago.
Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF.
Roll.
You sent me your book, and I think you sent it in paper or hardback, then paperback.
I did send it twice.
And you were like, this is a book for you. And I kept looking at the book, and then I read some of the book, Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll, and your persistence, which is a key element to ritual.
That's right.
Repetition. The repetitive nature of your requests to be on my show worked magic, Peter.
How did that happen?
How did it happen? You just kept bothering me. I kept seeing the book. I believed you that it would be something I'm interested in because, you know, I go back with the mystical thinking. I didn't realize at the time when you sent it to me that you're somewhat of an academic and your approach is thorough. It's not some weird scattershot personal history.
I tried.
Yeah, get up closer to the mic.
It's very easy to turn that kind of stuff into either completely skeptical to the point of dismissing everything or believing there's an occult conspiracy behind the whole record.
Well, I think that the way you approached it, which I think is reasonable, is that, you know, that the bottom line is that ritual magic has always existed.
Right.
It has existed in any time there have been humans and groups and communities, some form of ritual magic or some sort of transference onto to gods, to entities, to objects in order to try to find some magical consistency in life has always existed.
Yep. And sometimes it's just enough because it inspires musicians to want to do something interesting with their music. Most of the time, a lot of what we thought was happening was what the media or the fans imposed on it. And the bands love that, you know, ate it up.
Yeah, because it's an image thing. But I like right. how you start the book by really, you know, seeking out the source points of rock and roll, which is blues, which goes back to Africa. And there's nice bit of writing about the history of those religions that came up through Africa on into New Orleans, and then how the religions that became Christianized still maintained some of the mythology and talisman and rhythmic elements yep. of old music. And that was really, there was a mystical element to the foundation of rock and roll.
But that even that, especially with the early slave spirituals, is they had to do it in secret because they knew that the slave owners didn't want those elements, which they saw as barbaric, as satanic, to be part of that Christian worship. So even though the slaves accepted the Christian salvation story because it meant liberation from their awful plight,
right,
they still had to incorporate these old, it was a part of their DNA.
Yeah.
Right? So then that becomes what I think is pop music's first rebellious moment.
Yeah.
Right? And it's a spiritual rebellion. It's saying, okay, we get your Christianity, but we still have to worship our own way.
Right. And that comes up through, the first rock and roll recordings. And also what was considered black music at the time. And there was an element of black culture that was mystifying and magical and somewhat evil to white culture. It still is in some areas.
Right. Yeah.
But the music was coming up mostly through black performers.
That's right. There's also a really interesting moment. I couldn't find the actual source, but there was a early Pentecostal minister at the beginning of the Pentecostal movement who felt that his congregation just didn't have any energy in their prayer. It was very staid and yeah. white, you
right.
know?
Yeah.
And he said, come on, we can't let the devil keep all this good rhythm.
Yeah.
He was talking about the black church.
Right. right, right.
So they brought in the gospel, you know, that the yelling and the speaking in tongues and all of that stuff.
So that's what
and
shifted that.
That's what shifted that. And that was the church that Elvis was brought up in, the Assembly Church of God.
Yeah.
So he's criticized later by his own church, and he says, but I learned it from you.
Right, so let's talk about the evolution of this, because you're approaching the occult presence in rock and roll, which, well, some of it has foundation. There was some, after the blues, after early rock and roll, after Little Richard, where do we go? Where does it start becoming a part of rock and roll?
Well, LSD.
Okay.
Right, so you have these bands, you know, especially from England, that are returning to...
Wait, one before we do this.
Yeah.
The Crossroads is the great mythological...
That's right.
You
sell your soul to the devil.
And you were able to track that. What the possibility and what that myth came from.
That's right. So there's a couple of deities, mm-hmm. African Yoruban deities, Legba and Ishu. And these are not... They're not the devil, but they're trickster.
Right.
And that's key, right? Yeah. They're trickster deities.
Yeah.
And they're in all the many religions, the trickster, like the fox, Hermes, these are the
coyote.
That's right. These are the messengers. These are how you talk to the gods, is through these messenger spirits.
And the trickster is kind of duplicitous.
Yep.
Sometimes a joker.
That's right.
Sometimes a player of pranks.
Yep. That's right.
And misleading.
Right. Mm-hmm. But it's easy to see those horns on its head, right?
Mm-hmm.
And transfer that to this is the devil.
Right. So that's how that happened. That's how the myth was Christianized in a way and then mythologized through blues music.
That's right. So now these gods Ishu Legba become the devil at the crossroads. But prior to that, this was just an essential part of the African and Yoruban mythology.
So Robert Johnson didn't sell his soul to the devil?
No. Well, it even turns out it maybe wasn't even Robert Johnson and all that that story came from.
Who was it?
It is another fellow, Tommy Johnson.
Yeah.
And it was, he had this sort of ghostly voice, falsetto.
Yeah, Robert used that too.
Yeah, and so they said that he and his brother had this idea to sort of perpetuate this story.
Skip James had the falsetto too.
Yes. So you have this, this anything in music that felt otherworldly.
So they did it on purpose.
Yes.
So there you go. There's your beginning.
That's right. Exactly, because it creates a mythology. So
right.
All of rock, right, is about the creating of these mythologies.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, you know, part of my growing up was about interacting with that mythology through record, the album covers.
What's next, the Beatles?
The Beatles, right.
Paul is dead. Paul, why has he got no shoes on?
He's got no shoes on because you don't bury somebody with their shoes on. That's what I heard. Then there was If 34. Is that what the license plate said? He would have been 34 if he hadn't died.
Right. What about that guy who was standing there?
Oh, the Undertaker.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, right. Okay.
So my brother, older than me, 7 years older than me, he would play Revolution 9 for me.
Oh, boy.
I was 7 years old, and I was terrified. But
Number nine.
He played it backwards. Turned me on, Dead Man.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah.
I Buried Paul. That's one of
that was that. But I Buried Paul is at the end of Strawberry Fields.
Oh, that's right.
In that weird musical part where if you don't speed it up, it's like, it sounds like I'm very bored. But if you speed it up, it's I Buried Paul. It's Queer as Day.
Yep, perfect. Yeah. So my brother would play this for me.
Yeah.
And I was terrified of it. But then when he wasn't home, I would play it all by myself, you know? And then again, you add a little bit later. Add a little Dungeons and Dragons to that.
To that one?
Well, just to the whole thing of listening to
No, I get it, but like those,
that,
those, seemed like, those seemed like rumors and myths built around the Beatles. It wasn't necessarily the occult. It doesn't seem like the occult bands, you know, happened a little later, right?
No, but it has to be something underneath that is something that's very, something otherworldly has to be going on. How could Paul both be dead, but be able to be part of this story of his death.
I get it.
Right.
Okay.
This kind of a like a necromancy of some kind of play.
Right.
Right. And you and alongside that is their interest in Eastern mysticism.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this, especially at that part of the 60s, was all getting mixed up into this stew.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You get the weirdness of the mythology of the band's lives themselves.
Yeah.
Then you have their own interest in Eastern mysticism.
Mm-hmm.
Them taking LSD is Lucy in the Sky about it or isn't it about it?
Yeah.
You know, tongue, and there's always under their breath, it's not about it when he drops the acid, right?
Right.
You know?
Right.
So you have all this. This is this stew.
Yeah.
And the counterculture is hungry for it because the war doesn't want to end.
Right.
Their parents' church isn't giving them anything.
Yeah, and all of it, it's just blowing your minds. There's a huge cultural shift, and certainly mysticism and what became New Ageism and what was previously occult was very popular in all different ways. There were literally magical groups and communities
that
were based in ritual magic.
Well, right here you have the Source Family.
The Process Church. The other one, the Source, right? What was the other one? Children of God.
Yep.
The Mansons.
Yep. It always takes that dark turn, ultimately. You know, that's the other part of it, is you fuel all this. And one thing that's interesting about sort of the occult imagination, that I like to call it, and that kind of magical thinking that I know for me personally, when I fueled it with stuff like acid, everything just connects to something else. There's no end. There's no final message. There's just, you have to keep digging, and then there's another sign that points to another sign and another sign.
Yeah, but
that points
but
to
that's
right.
But
symbol,
that's
right?
That's magical. That's mystical thinking. That's magical thinking.
That's right. But it turns dark when there's a moment in. Did you ever see Imagine?
Yeah, when it turns dark is when you believe it, when you actually have a moment where you believe it's all connected.
Right.
Then it becomes quite overwhelming, and it's impossible not to think that you're a secret agent of some kind.
That's right.
Am I the only one that knows this?
Yeah, exactly.
Then you're in trouble.
Right. Because then it's, and it has been said that it's just as psychotically self-centered to believe that you're Jesus as to believe you're the devil. There's no...
Right.
Right.
Right. I always thought that when I got the most psychotic, that I was just sort of like, uh-oh, I've been assigned the job to reveal this.
Yes.
I didn't think I was a prophet. I didn't think I was Jesus or the devil. I was just sort of like... I'm privy to this information.
But then the information changed almost immediately as soon as you got it.
No, because I was a sign reader.
Okay.
I would see signs, but I didn't know what they represented.
Yeah, I had that.
Yeah, which is what is compelling about a lot of it, whether it's done on purpose or not, whether I buried Paul is there on purpose or not, it's compelling, and it starts to create its own narrative.
That's right.
That is not denied or not confirmed, which is a great tool of magic.
Right, exactly.
Never deny, never confirm. So... You know, but the ritual space, well, you know, all this stuff, mythologizing and images and rumors that become myths is one thing. But it does seem to me that there were some artists that actually affected and utilized ritual space and magic elements in order to deliver the goods.
Yes.
Right?
Yep. Yep.
Who are they?
So it gets a little complicated, though.
Yeah.
Okay? Because you have a place at which... the music itself becomes the ritual space,
mm-hmm.
which is different from, saying, drawing a pentagram on your floor and trying to conjure
up. Yeah, just put that on the cover.
That's right. Exactly. So Zeppelin, I think, is a very interesting example because you have somebody, first you have Robert Plant, very interested in the mythology of, you know, ancient Britain,
yeah, right.
Right? Brings all that. That's where you get the Tolkien references.
Yeah.
You know, there's more
to me relatively uninteresting.
Yeah, but there's more Tolkien references in Zeppelin than the devil.
Sure,
you know, song per song.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Then you have Page, who is very interested in magic. I think in a very deep way.
Yeah,
cares about it. Thinks that. Stuff like what Aleister Crowley had to say is important. And what's manifested is where I think if magic is real, it's where it really exists. It's
right.
It's in that transmission between the musician and the audience.
Yes.
Right? So there's a sacred space that's created
yes.
there. And we, in whatever that moment, we're in the show, we're listening to the music, we give over to this thing. And it's real, right?
Yeah,
it's
that
real.
Is, there's sure, a, that's I'm, magic.
That's magic.
Right? Music is magic in general.
Right.
You know, just by nature of the space it occupies, you know, in our minds and in the air and you know, like just even the opening riff of Satisfaction being delivered to Keith while he was half asleep, there's something mysterious about that. And that's pretty much a pop song.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't, you know, really lend itself to occult thinking, although it was sort of calling out corporate culture in
yes.
a way.
Yeah, so it becomes kind of its own, again, it's a act of, what I like to think is that, it, particularly as it comes to rock and roll, that rock itself becomes a weapon of spiritual rebellion,
uh-huh.
right?
Uh-huh.
And it's often a spiritual rebellion that sees itself in opposition to traditional mainstream Judeo-Christian norms.
From the beginning.
From the very beginning,
mm-hmm.
right? Even when the slaves were singing their version of their spirituals, it was in opposition to the normative, mainstream, white Christian way of worship.
So you're saying it always occupied that space, and on some level, the best rock and roll is something that pushes up against
yes.
anything mainstream, anything dogmatic, anything you know, dug in.
That's right. And even prior to that, go all the way back to the early avant-garde classical composers.
Sure.
At every moment, you see these composers, somebody like Ravel and, you know, they were always, as much as they were doing this, they were also joining Rosicrucian orders.
Sure.
Right? Because, and looking also at non-traditional spiritual modes, because they needed something that felt like it, spiritually, they needed something that felt like it matched what they were doing musically.
But also, you know, I think the gift of that is, and the reason for it is that, you know, how do you unleash the possibilities of your imagination? So
that's
like
exactly that's the that's it yeah.
Right, so the tools of ritual magic, whether it be a sacred order or something, you know, more intimate, you know, is really sort of like we're doing something, you know, certainly, you know, transgressive in a way,
yes,
something, you know, alternative and maybe even against the law, yeah.
And dangerous
to see where that takes our minds,
right? Exactly.
Well, let's talk about the late, great David Bowie, because there's been a lot of speculation about the arc of his career and his characters and his different manifestations as being very conscious acts of ritual magic.
Yes.
What do you think? You're now the spokesperson.
Yes.
The author of Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. Tell me about the life of David Bowie and all his character manifestations and what they were servicing.
So I think, and this sounds like a little bit of rock and roll hyperbole, mm-hmm. but I think that he really was the true rock magician
mm-hmm.
because he... So there's an interesting thing. There's a definition of magic that... Crowley says that says, you know, magic is the art and science of causing change in accordance with your will.
Right.
And a little bit later, this woman, Dionne Fortune, said, actually, it's causing a change in consciousness to occur in accordance with the will.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see Bowie as somebody who at every turn actually was changing his consciousness through these different personas,
mm-hmm.
fully inhabiting them,
mm-hmm.
and all along the way using the sort of mythologies of various magic. And, I mean, he even went so far as to become interested in sort of the weird Nazi occult, mythologies.
The SS stuff, yeah.
And he saw, you know, that as also a place where populism becomes its own kind of theater, which becomes its own kind of ritual change in the public consciousness.
The Hitler was very aware of that.
Exactly.
And it enabled him to manifest his will to, you know, horrible ends.
That's right. And so a lot of people would retroactively say that, and I don't know,
the whole Raiders of the Lost Ark.
That's the whole Raiders of the Lost Ark, exactly. Bowie would look back on that later and be wholly ashamed that he embraced the kind of slightly fascist. Yeah. He said it was the cocaine and just not thinking it through.
Well, no, he applied his intelligence to dark matter, because when you're jacked on drugs and in a psychotic state and have a lot of money, you're going to turn to the darkness.
That's right, exactly. So, yeah. I mean, think about it, even as go back to any of these guys. They were young.
Uh-huh.
A lot of them grew up poor. Suddenly you have more money than you know what to do with, you know?
And a lot of them died.
Exactly.
With their dumb games.
That's right. One of the things that I found out later about Bowie after he died that just made me feel so good was that later in his life, he loved being sober.
Yeah.
He loved his sobriety.
Yeah, well, he became a very sort of, he was always elegant, but he became a very sophisticated, I think, moraled and polite English gentleman.
That's right, exactly.
So as you move through all this stuff, now, yeah, the conclusion is that rock and roll is magic, and that it's magic because of the very nature of what magic is, which is an opposition to established norms.
That's right. It's also what we need it to be. So there's a lot that we as fans and critics and media impose on it.
Uh-huh.
You know, we want to say, you know, there was somebody who wrote that Mick Jagger was the most evil man alive, you know, that he was the devil personified.
Yeah, I remember.
But he saw himself, he saw himself as the trickster, not as Satan.
Right, well, he is, yeah.
Yeah, but he liked
it. I'll buy it.
He brought all that on to himself, partly because he liked the attention that came as part of embracing that. As you know, let me.
And it's funny, her Satanic Majesty is not a great record.
It's not a great record. Nope. The Lantern's a pretty good song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you get like later, as we move into, you know, what really becomes defined as satanic rock, that's a fucking joke. Yep. Like, it's weird because, like, American Satanism and Satanism in general as a specific ideology and practice was really a huckster job.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, how Satan figures into other magical systems or the Beast or Beelzebub or whoever, whatever its manifestation is, was usually part of a broader system.
That's right? Yeah.
So then when, you know, Anton LaVey summons this fucking, you know, ridiculous, you know, bit of business, which is, you know, yeah, just a gutting of Crowley and everything else. And it's basically just sort of do what you want.
Yeah. It's a liberation. It's a libertarian theology.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. But it's sort of like it's half baked in a way.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think so because and I have to say, and I don't want to, you know,
you want to trivialize Satanism?
Yeah, I don't want to trivialize Satanism, but like the Church of Satan thing. You know, the current that's doing all these things with trying to get the Baphomet statues put up and to do. I kind of wish it was like a real Wiccan pagan group that was doing it, right? Or even the local Hindu temple. I wish they were the ones that were asking for a statue of Shiva.
Shiva, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because if you ask
There's context.
If you ask these guys, they say, we don't believe in anything. We're atheists.
Yeah.
So why do you want a religious statue of?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But... You know,
they're
trolls,
pranksters.
They're great at it.
Yeah.
There's no doubt, and they're really showing. I think fundamentalism, at its core, is problematic.
Right. It's just a direct opposition. It's a reaction.
That's right.
It's not a system in a way.
That's right.
It's a reaction. Like punk rock would fall in the same. Punk rock, for the most part, is not magic per se, but a reaction, an aggressive reaction.
That's right.
Right.
Yep. Yes.
Yeah. So. I just want to say on the record that I'm fine with magic. I'm okay with some of the darker elements of magic that don't hurt people. And I'm okay with the darker elements of magic that have, you know, delivered us some of the best music in the world. I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
I'm on board.
Yep.
I'm a member of the magical circle.
There's a story that I write about in the book when Zeppelin was recording Three. They asked the engineer, Terry Manning.
Mm-hmm.
Page went up to him and he said, I want you to take this quote, do what thou wilt, and I want you to etch it into the inner groove. And Manning said, I can't do that. It's going to wreck. And he said, I need you to do it because we have to get Crowley's message out to the world.
Yeah.
So Manning humored him. He said it was a very precarious thing, getting the master in a way that he could get down above it, etch it in. He said it was maybe 20, 30 years later, Terry Manning was watching cable TV and he flipped through, it was a 700 club. And the minister held up the album.
Yeah.
Led Zeppelin 3.
Yeah.
The Devil in Music. Right here, close up camera, there's the inner thing. And Manning looked and he said to himself, I did that. You know?
But it's not, it was only on one pressing, right? Is it hard to find?
I think you can get it.
On an old Zeppelin 3, like on the, you know, right at between the last song and the label.
Exactly. That's smooth. And, you know, remember later, punk bands would always write little messages.
No, there's stuff. There's a lot of stuff written in there. Yeah,
that was always fun trying to look for those. Yeah.
Now we got to go look at my old Zeppelin 3.
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah.
And see if it's there.
That would be good.
Well, so, you know, you cover a lot in the book. You thread it through a sort of memoir.
Yep.
Of your own sort of musical enlightenment.
Yep.
And how's the book doing? Is it magic?
Pretty good. You know, you always, it's like you think people buy books, but then you always want them to buy more.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The book I did before this sold 50 copies. So yeah.
Which one was that?
Too Much to Dream. Uh-huh. Psychedelic American Boyhood.
Uh-huh.
That was my memoir of my lapsed youth.
Uh-huh. So now you tightened it up.
Tightened it up. Got outside of myself.
Good, man. Well, it was good talking to you,
Thanks very much.
That was Peter Biebergall. Nice guy. I like the book. Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. All right, so now what? Now let's talk to Joseph Arthur. He's got a new record out. The most recent one is called The Family. I'm also a fan of some of his other records. I really liked his tribute to Lou Reed, mostly acoustic renditions of Lou Reed music. And it was fun to meet him and hang out because he's just one of those guys where you're like, oh, we got a thing. We got something in common. There's something, we know each other from another life or something. This is me and Joseph Arthur. You live in a garage in Redford.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, not officially. It's like live workspace, yeah.
Is this a sad story, Joseph, or is it a nice garage?
I heard you recently call this place magical.
Uh-huh.
And you said that you really have come to believe that it's magical.
Got to.
And I have come to believe, and I don't know, I identify with you, Mark.
So I feel it.
I do. I identify. So I also think that my garage is magical. It's just on the different coast.
Well, the thing about spaces in general, you know, I think especially with music, that, you know, they do take on, they are part of it. They are part, like, you know, yeah, whether you can identify it or not when you listen to the music, you know, but that room is that room, and right, the music's only going to sound like it sounds in that room. You yeah know, they do have that element, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and like a lot of times, like the greatest studios are just like, yeah, pretty underwhelming spaces.
Yeah, like Muscle Visually Shoals.
Yeah, they're like, just a room. But I usually always put it, I like think of it as like it's down to like sort of supernatural.
Yeah,
like yeah, that they're spirits or something.
Do
I mean,
you
have you? Yeah, I think I go that way. I don't know if I believe it or not, but I tend to.
I have gone that way in my life.
Yeah,
but then like, but then I have to identify the beings, and you know what kind of spirits,
right?
And like, you know, why were they sent here? What do they want from me?
Right?
Are they going to turn on me?
Right. Yeah.
Like if I'm going to deal with spirits, define spirits, there's always a chance that they'll start fucking with you the wrong way.
That's true. They often do.
Right.
They often do fuck with you the wrong way on purpose.
Yeah. And I, you know, see, if you believe that, I guess it lets you off the hook to a degree.
Yeah.
But I could also just believe that there's a coziness or something. Like I could probably, like I used to be a lot more mystical in my thinking
yeah
before I met somebody who was a, you know, like a guy who, like if you look at, what's the math word I want? The odds of something happening.
Uh-huh.
Do you know, like if you really look at, if you break down a situation, like why the fuck did I just run into that guy?
Right.
In my neighborhood.
Yeah.
Like if you really break down, you know, what is your circle of life?
Right.
And you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. It kind of takes a little bit of the poetry out of it. I'm not.
Or know, puts it in. I mean, I'm alive because of alcoholism. I mean, my parents met in a bar.
Really?
Yeah. Like, so I, you know, I can't be too mad at alcoholism.
Which one was an alcoholic?
Well, I mean, my you know, my dad's got some issues with that. He's sober, though.
Oh, he got
know
sober?
Yeah,
like,
he's
for real?
Yeah, he's sober, yeah.
Like, program sober?
Yeah, he got program sober, yeah.
No kidding?
Yeah.
For how long?
He's been sober a long, long time.
That's fucking good.
Yeah, a long time.
Did you grow up in it?
I did grow up in it. Damn, we're going there quick. We were talking about mystical ghosts and stuff, and now we're, like, in my family. You are a sensei.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Well, the new record, like, yeah, I know it's not about yeah your family per se, but, you know, there's a few of your albums that are narratively driven. So yeah, you are a storyteller.
Yeah, oh, thank you. Thank you for saying that. But I was getting the reason I'm alive because
yeah
of alcoholism was the alcoholism of my mother's, at the time, roommate. Who was like prodding her
once removed,
who were yeah like this was years and years obviously years and years ago before I was born, but like so yeah she made my mom take her to the bar, and that's
yeah
where my mom and dad met. They wouldn't have met outside of that. My mom's from West Virginia,
yeah,
and my dad's from Akron, Ohio. I'm from Akron, Ohio.
Which Akron, is
Earthquaker
Ohio.
Devices, you know, shout out to them. I know
they're all there. They're all there. You know
yeah
them?
Yeah.
You're a pedal guy.
A pedal guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah.
You'll layer the sounds.
That's true, yeah.
You got brothers and sisters?
I got a sister, older sister.
What'd she do?
2.5 years older. She is a painter, and she raises two kids.
Painter, huh?
Yeah.
How old are you? You mind me asking?
I don't mind. I'm 44.
Okay, I'm 52.
Yeah.
44.
44.
So you're growing up in Akron.
Uh-huh, in
you're
the 70s.
In the 70s.
Well, yeah, so
late
the
70s.
80s in the,
right.
Yeah.
So what kind of, like, when did you start doing the music?
Well, my sister, I guess, there was a piano that suddenly
she
appeared.
Older?
She's older.
Yeah.
So then she was interested in piano lessons, and then so I kind of, like, just got swept up into that, and I hated that, but then... You know, it's funny because I got into Jaco Pastorius. I got into bass and
what do you
I got
mean?
Into
like
Jaco Pastorius, and you did that interview
with Flea and Robert Trujillo,
which was great. Did you watch that documentary?
Sure, I did. Yeah,
it's wonderful.
Did you like it?
I'm a huge Jaco Pastorius nut job. I love.
Are
it.
You really?
Yeah, I ripped all the frets out of my Fender precision bass. I wanted to be a jazz fusion bass player. Like that's what I was in this band called Frankie Starr and Chill Factor when I was in high school.
And it was
school.
A fusion band?
It was a blues band, and we opened up for like like Stevie Ray Vaughan a couple times.
Really?
I play like, we play like 5 nights a week.
And you're playing bass.
And I was playing bass.
So you're like boom, 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 boom.
Yeah. Just like dun, 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 dun. You know, and funk stuff too.
Yeah.
And we were good. I mean, I'd make like a lot of money. I probably made more money then than now, but you know.
Playing in a blues band.
Playing bars. Yeah, playing bars. I could have kept doing it. I mean, and then.
How old were you?
This was like 11th and 12th grade in high school, so I'm like 17, and then
so you're playing out.
I was playing 5 nights a week,
not guitar,
bass.
Yeah, all
and
bass.
And I didn't sing until I was like 21. I was gonna be a jazzer, you know.
That's weird. So,
it is
but
weird.
Did you study jazz? It's not completely weird. It kind of makes sense because like I can't wrap my brain around fusion and enjoying it. Like I can.
That makes a lot of sense.
I can see Jocko is a great bass player.
I understand that. And I feel that way too, to a degree. I mean, that's why I do what I do. I like songs and hooks
And
repetition and
blues
stuff.
And stuff.
Yeah, and I like the blues.
Like fusion, just sort of like there's something cheesy about keyboard sometimes that I can't quite get past, even if it's fucking Chick Corea.
Right.
Or even if it's that dude, that crazy alpha dude in Weather Report that made Jocko's life so difficult.
I know, Joe Zawin.
Yeah.
Joe Zawinfall.
Is that his name?
Yeah, that was an interesting...
Yeah, he seemed like a real terror, that guy.
Yeah.
And I know he's a great player, but there's just something about... I mean, like, look,
You know how us artists are. We have egos and freak out and insecurities.
Oh, yeah, we're disaster.
We're disasters. Just,
Most of the good ones are. But, like, I can listen to Miles, like, when he shifted.
Well, I was going to say, a good window into, like, enjoying fusion, if you ask me, is Bitches Brew.
Yeah, I can
Miles
listen
Davis.
To that
I mean,
all
that's
day long.
Like, yeah, that's, like, mystical. Going back to Ghosts in Garages, that's, like, mystical music.
I think so, too. I mean, the one I listen to a lot... For some reason, is the Jack Johnson record, which is really kind of stripped down, man.
I don't really know that one that well.
Yeah, I guess it was done as a soundtrack for a movie about Jack Johnson. And I actually have someone turn me on to like the full studio session, so I have all that shit.
Mm-hmm.
But I have the record.
Yeah,
and it's really lean, and it's like it's like, apparently he told John McLaughlin to pretend like he didn't know how to play guitar.
That's amazing.
And
I love stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like anytime, like there's just like that opening, be creative, be free, and also be free to be as sort of bad as you want to be. Like,
yeah.
If you give yourself permission to not be great.
Yeah.
That's a big key. I mean, and that's like huge in what you do, just going out and,
you got to take the risk.
Prepared material. Like what if you go up there and, What if you do?
What if you fail?
Yeah.
In that context, you try not to fail in front of too many people.
Right.
But like if you're working on shit, you got to work on shit.
Do you ever fail like when you go up there and like you like walk with a loss?
Or do you redeem it and then walk away
and know that something failed?
It's more embarrassing than a loss. Like I know when things don't hit. And, you know, depending on where I'm doing it, I can usually counter that by acknowledging it.
Right. That's what I always do. I always acknowledge the awkwardness.
Right.
And then that's like,
Yeah, it's better.
It's better.
But like in the big world of professionalism, it does imply a certain inconsistency in your ability to do the job.
I guess so. People could look at it that way.
I like that Joe Arthur, but he fucks up a lot of songs and he kind of talks about it a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's all right.
Yeah.
But I think that is true about creativity, that you have to, you know, not be afraid to fail. Like with guitar, like it took me a long time to realize, like the only reason I never really committed to it in a real way is I don't like learning songs.
Right.
And I sort of just like, you know, I think I'm a pretty good player, but I never thought I compared to real players. But like in the last few years, I sort of just realized like, what the fuck does that even mean?
And who does?
Yeah,
who
but what does that mean
who, like,
in rock and roll, really?
Right.
I mean, there's some bad players. So arguably, some of the best players that we know are not that great.
Right. I mean, well, you're talking about technical level. Yeah, it doesn't.
But that's what I compare myself to. It's like, I don't know my scales. I don't know how to noodle. I can't just, you know, listen to songs and know them. And I don't like learning songs.
Well, I don't like learning songs either, which is why I started writing songs.
Really?
Because, yeah, there was like the people in... Like there was that talented kid in everybody's high school who could just hear
noodle
a song and play the
like
thing on piano.
Like I remember Mike Garcia could play Van Halen's Eruption.
Right,
and I'm like, fuck it.
There's that guy in every high school, and I was not him. And what would invariably happen, I'd start trying to figure something out, and then I would just start getting drifting away with this new progression, and then start singing something or do something or make something up out of it. I used to just compose, but I wonder why, like, the thing with comedians and musicians, like how so many really good comedians are, like, really good musicians.
Are they really good?
But this is the question. Because, like, some of them are, yeah. Like, I mean, they could be putting out records. I mean, like, you know, like, when you think of, like, oh, the Flight of the Conchords, they made those, like,
that kind of thing,
and the Mighty Bush or whatever and stuff like that. Yeah. Or, like, and then Jimmy Fallon is...
Yeah, he can play pretty good.
He's talented, but... I always think, like, the only difference is, for some reason, comedians can't do it without irony. That's the
thing. Well, if you're a comic and you have musical talent, it really becomes a sort of, like, how do you integrate it into your act without being stupid?
Right.
Like, or hacky.
But why can't a comedian then be also a serious musician where this is not ironic and not funny?
I don't think they can't. Is there any case of that? Well, we might respect music too much.
I think you do that a little bit. I mean, I think you're, like... sort of doing that.
Like, if I played, because, like, I really want to play with other people.
Right.
But I don't want to make a big deal of it. I don't want to have a goal in mind. I would just like to collaborate on that level, because I don't really know how. And every time I've done it, just on nights where Brendan Small has some dudes, like,
I
like it. Yeah, because it's just something I have to integrate in my life. You find the guys, you make a schedule, you get a space, and go fuck off for a while.
Yeah.
I play on the podcast because, like, I just like the sound of it in my head, and I like fucking with this stuff, and I like mic in the amp, and I just, like, I don't put any real effort into it, and, like, a lot of times I'm just making it up as I go along.
Yeah.
And I don't know why.
It's a nice way to, like, conclude things. It is. I like it. I mean, I've been listening to the podcast since before you did that.
Right.
And I like it.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
But let's get back to you in Ohio.
Okay.
So you're playing in a blues band.
Yeah.
You want to be Jaco. You rip the frets out.
Yeah.
You want to do fusion.
I want to do fusion, yeah. I don't know. Yeah, Stanley Clark and Jaco were kind of my heroes.
Oh, yeah. I remember Stanley Clark's band.
Well, you know what I liked about the Jaco documentary was that because I wore, like, just loved him as a kid. And then, you know, you get new heroes and you come up and you do other things and stuff like that. But it just reminded me of that sort of part of just music for the sake of it, or just art, like, just art, not thinking about it in terms of a commodity, but thinking, just being an artist, just how much of a gift that actually is. And, you know, and to the heartbreaking way he sort of lost it, you know.
Did you think that way always? I mean, did you think, were you thinking that way as a young person, that this
is a gift, or
that it's not a commodity necessarily?
I never really thought money until, like, I got into my 40s. I'm a latecomer to being financially concerned. Not because I haven't needed to be. You know, I've never been rich or anything, but just, I think something happens when you click into the 40s.
And you don't know if you're going to have enough money
to
ride it out.
Yeah, well, I mean, like...
How do I ride it out?
You went through that, so I identify that with that, too. And then this whole thing kind of, like, blossomed for you in a big way, so...
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting that our career paths are similar in that we keep trying.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I figure. It's and as long as you're not bitter, that's the main thing, like... is just not being bitter, you know. And the way I'm a lot of times people come up to me and be like, you should be so much bigger than you are. I don't understand it. And I, you know, I used to get into that and then feel bad, and now I'm just like, you know what? There is no should in pop culture. Pop culture is this cold thing that doesn't care, and it doesn't have anything personally against you.
Yeah, the cream doesn't rise to the top. Usually the curdled part.
Or it just is, yeah. I don't know. It helps to not be bitter, you know. So.
Yeah. Well, is that something you had to work on?
Of course. I mean, every day I'm bitter as hell right now. I want to jump over the table and start, like,
what?
Fighting.
What did I do?
No, I don't know.
What did I do?
I'm just kidding.
I got lucky. I'm on your team. You know. Yeah. But, okay, so you're doing, when do you start sort of defining your sound? Because one thing is that you do have definite sound. I didn't really know who you were until I think you reached out to me, maybe personally.
Right.
But I got that, what I remember really listening to was the Lou Reed tribute album.
Oh, right.
And, like, it came from somewhere. I guess somebody sent it to me because you wanted them to. But, like, I was a big Lou Reed fan, and I really appreciated the earnest approach yeah. sort of honoring those songs.
Yeah.
And I didn't really know who you were, but then I'm like, well, he must be a guy.
You tweeted. That's why I reached out, because I was like a fan already.
Yeah.
But I didn't, you know, then... Right. And I didn't think you, and you tweeted, and I was like, holy shit.
Right. Know? Well, because I was like, you know, I listen to a lot of records that come through.
Yeah.
And I get a lot of records.
Yeah.
And some things grab you and some things don't.
Yeah.
So, like, listening to the Lou thing, because, like, how do you do those songs? And, you know, you did them sort of differently than your records. I mean, they were stripped down.
Right.
Almost all acoustic versions, basically.
Yeah, it's a trip. I start a lot of records wanting to make something really stripped down.
I mean,
and that record in particular was not even my idea. It was a guy named Bill Bentley, who's a really... great guy, A&R guy of Vanguard at the time, and it was his idea for me to do that, and I realized it would be kind of a weird thing to do, and I just thought, well, I'll just try it, something very simple, and I did the sort of Brian Eno Set Limitations thing, which was just like, I'm going to just do this all acoustic instruments and just use microphones, and so I did an acoustic bass, acoustic piano, acoustic guitar. I just made it all acoustic,
right,
and kept it really simple, and it just worked out. It just sounded how it sounded, and they liked it.
Well, what's interesting about it is that, you know, when you do a song that is so sort of elevated, I think you did Satellite of Love on there, right?
Uh-huh.
That was one of my favorite Lou Reed songs.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you take it down to that. You take it down to the basics and just the poetry of Lou. Like, you know, it's interesting that it sort of becomes a different song,
right?
But yet the words are enough to sort of keep it high, keep it elevated.
Yeah.
And I think you must have had a lot of respect for that guy.
Oh yeah, a tremendous amount. Yeah,
Did you have a relationship with him?
I knew him. Yeah. Well, I got signed to Peter Gabriel's label. I went from Akron. I moved to Atlanta randomly.
So we're talking about late 90s and
late 90s. Yeah.
And like, you're in Akron. Are you playing out as your own thing?
And by the time late 90s happened, I was in New York. So I left Akron in 90. I graduated high school in 90. I went to the same high school as the Black Keys as well. And Chris,
did you know those
and
guys?
Chrissy Hynde. No, they're younger.
Chrissy's older.
Chrissy's older, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely like a Rust Belt rock and roll town.
Yeah, there's something about it.
Yeah.
And you know, that secret society comes from there, too.
Which one? That's right.
The one that shall remain nameless.
Dr. Bob and Bill. That's right. You can go to the headquarters.
The thing. I went to the headquarters.
I mean,
somebody I know went to the headquarters.
The pilgrimage.
I grew up near the headquarters.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. The American geniuses, those two.
Yeah.
So you go to New York with
I went to Atlanta, and then I like...
Wait, did you go to Atlanta before New York?
After high school.
Okay. Why Atlanta?
Because there was this band going, and it was 4 days after I graduated high school, and I wasn't going to go to college, and I just was like, okay, let's go. And I left.
Your band?
Well, it was a band I was in.
Uh-huh. You know, yeah. Which one? Not the blues band?
They were called 10 Zen Men.
10 Zen Men?
Yeah.
And what kind of music was that?
We played like funk rock. Uh-huh. I did a lot of slapping and popping on the bass.
So you're still a bass player.
So you would have loved it. In other words, it's the kind of music you would have listened to all the time.
Well, I like those Chili Peppers.
No, yeah. That's,
I but, like
but
funk.
But please like calm down on the slapping and popping. I like the
I
Chili
like
Peppers
popping.
Too. I do too.
Yeah.
Anyway, so...
You're swapping and popping, and you
so
get
I go
in
to
car,
Atlanta. Go to Atlanta, and then I'm working all kinds of jobs. And my last job's at Clark Music, which is a guitar shop. I sold guitars. We sold Fender guitars and
Little Music Store.
Yeah, Little Music Store on Ponce de Leon. You know it?
Nope.
Oh, anyway, it turned into a pawn shop, and then I don't know. And then I, something hit me when I was around 21, where I was like, you know, if I don't play like crazy busy bass lines all the time, I could maybe just like. Think about melody and lyrics.
Yeah.
And so I started just playing more acoustic guitar, and I made a demo like of that stuff and gave it to a friend in that mysterious program.
Yeah.
I shall remain nameless, I guess.
Are you in it?
I mean, I think so.
Okay.
You know, I don't know. I have a funny relationship with it.
But you don't drink?
I'm not drinking now. Yeah. Market's rough.
Yeah.
No, I am. I quit drinking again.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Well,
I got the issues.
If you say you quit drinking again, you need to quit drinking.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like
that's one way. Yeah. That, you know, like,
you know, if anyone says, I got to quit, you got to quit.
Or the other one I like is, if you ever wonder, do you have a drinking problem? You do.
Exactly. That's it. Right.
But so then, yeah. And then that demo tape randomly got to Peter Gabriel.
Just you on acoustic.
Well, it was a little like a couple, little bit of Jape on there.
Jape?
Yeah.
What's that?
I need like that word. Jape. It's like if we were joking, I'd say, quit japing me.
Oh, okay.
So
some
Jape, like it's an like old word.
Yeah, for like
I want to bring
bells
it back,
and
though.
Whistles.
Yeah.
Is that what it is?
Maybe.
When you say there's a
I think you
Jape?
Could. Yeah, you could. It could be that.
Well,
yeah.
What are you referring to exactly?
When I'm saying Jape, I mean like fake drums and you know.
Oh, okay.
And,
all right.
Yeah.
Right. But you like that shit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I do like that shit. Yeah, we disagree on the cheesiness of synthesizers.
No. I like
your aesthetic, but I also like a cheesy synthesizer thrown in to, like, offset that.
I love that. I've got some, like, I've heard synthesizers that I like.
Oh, okay.
But, like, at that time when they were sort of new.
Right.
Like, look.
Oh, I get you. Yeah.
When people are soloing on them.
Oh, right.
If yeah. they're a texture... Fine. So, all right. So your acoustically japed demo.
Yeah, it got to Peter Gabriel.
Who at this time, what is it, 96?
This is 95? Like, this is 94 probably. 95. 94, 95, yeah.
So Peter's a pretty big deal.
He's a big deal, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Unique sound. No one sounds like Peter Gabriel.
Right.
He's got his thing.
Well, it was such an interesting, weird world for me to like kind of go into because like here I go for this weird fusion thing. Like I was, yeah. like, you know, like I was already off. Like I meet people now. They're like, oh yeah, when I was 14, I started yeah. listening to Bob Dylan and the Beatles and right. all this and learning how to write those songs. I'm like, man, I went about it the whole wrong way. But Peter ended up bringing Lou Reed to my audition for a real, like, to the...
So you send this demo in, and mm-hmm. then all of a sudden, like, you go to New York for the audition?
I kind of, yeah. My best friend, Jeremy, was living there, and so I was kind of starting to head into New York. Right. I've been a New Yorker now for, like, over 20 years.
Right.
So I went there, and then, yeah, Peter brought Lou. It was this little club called The Fez.
I know. That The Fez was downstairs
yeah, you probably
at Time.
It. Yeah, yeah, Time.
Wasn't that little.
Right. Well,
it was a couple hundred.
Yeah, a couple hundred.
And it was nice. It was in a basement. It was a nice stage situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, the
stage
guys.
You could feel the train. You could hear the...
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
They started Stella there. You know, Michael, Ian Black... David Wayne and Michael Showalter started their show Stella at Fez. Mm-hmm. So it was actually a comedy venue when that show was there.
Oh.
But so all right. So what's the outfit? How many people are you on stage with?
I was by myself, and I was an acoustic guitar, and I was like being a singer songwriter straight up, like. And I was just faking. I was like, what in the heck? Like, what? Yeah, I guess I can cuss on this.
Sure.
I always think it's funny when people say, can I cuss?
Yeah, yeah.
But I just had that same instinct.
Yeah. Like, you've done like, some radio in your day.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to watch it.
Yeah, like, what the heck is going on
yeah,
here?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, but it was like an out-of-body experience. I just played my songs. I have no idea if I was any good or not. And then I walked right up to Lou, who was like, I mean, I at that point, I was a huge like Lou Reed fan, too. And I was just like, hey,
that's
and he was
good.
Like, I like the song King of Hide and Seek, and I don't have a song called King of Hide and Seek, but
right.
there is a lyric of that.
Oh,
like,
right.
And
so
I thought, that is a better,
about it.
Yeah, I was like, that is a better title than what I was calling that. Like, and then we went out to eat, and we're- and
You and Peter Gabriel, or you
me,
and Lou?
Me, Peter Gabriel, and Lou.
Holy shit, and you're like 21?
I was like, yeah, like 24.
Oh, wow.
And Dolly Parton was sitting like- in the booth next to
Get
us.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah. And they were starstruck by Dolly Parton.
Why
more than
be?
The other way around.
Well, wait,
and then I found out, sorry to keep...
Where was that?
She was originally the one he wanted to sing Don't Give Up, what Kate Bush sang. The
oh, who? Peter?
Dolly Parton. Yeah.
Peter Gabriel wanted her to?
Peter Gabriel wanted Dolly Parton.
Yeah.
Yeah, originally.
So where were you eating?
That was just right next door. There was a restaurant next door. I actually don't really remember the name of it, but I remember it as being like a block away. And
right.
I remember walking with Lou and some guy coming up and saying something, and Lou just sort of, you know... acknowledging and shielding. But I just remembered thinking, wow, because it was like my first... you know, like entree into like being on that side of things.
Well, like, yeah, with like, a guy like Lou, when you've created in your lifetime an army of freaks and weirdos,
yeah,
you somehow have to protect yourself against, you know, what you've created.
Yeah, I think he, you know, he was out and about a lot. I mean,
no,
even in later life, you know, like
New York guy.
He was a New York guy, and so like if you know if somebody has a story where oh Lou was rude, you know, it's like, well, what do you want? I mean,
yeah, no, of
well,
course
you would be too.
Look,
if it, you know,
I love Lou. I was listening to Lou yesterday.
Yeah, I love Lou too.
But I like that you had this experience with, like, he was like a West Side guy, the West Side, like Meatpacking District, right? He lived over there.
Yeah.
I think he's pretty visible walking his little doggy, I think, sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so you go to dinner with these two and.
Went to dinner and then. And that when Lou was talking to me about publishing and stuff like that and what not to do and don't sign this. And
what's Peter doing?
And Peter then was like, oh, we're actually offering him a publishing deal too.
Oh, yeah.
So it was like.
So this was your deal pitch. This was like,
I mean,
you know,
like,
we want you to record.
It was crazy.
It was for Peter.
It was a lot like, you know, just kind of like, I mean, when I think about it now, it just seems crazy. He had this studio in England called Real World Studios. It's in Box, England, which is like 10 minutes outside of Bath.
Okay.
And he had this thing called Recording Week, which was like all these musicians in producers and stuff, like Joe Strummer came, and like Brian Eno, and
you met
Chuck.
Those guys.
I met those guys. Yeah, I met,
you met
Joe.
Eno.
Yeah, I met. I ate dinner with Eno.
You did?
Yeah.
What was that like?
Well,
because
Marcus Straps produced my first record. Actually, Brian Eno sang on my first record.
Really?
Yeah, Brian Eno and Peter Gabriel are singing on the song called Mercedes from my first record. I think I was told to me that it's the only song they both synced on together.
Ever.
That's what I heard.
What the fuck is Brian Eno like, dude?
Well, I mean, you know as well as I do. I mean, he was a nice guy.
Okay.
You know, but we didn't connect on a deep personal level.
He's
but
like,
he's
talk about mystic.
I mean, right. Yeah.
His influence on fucking music and then coming, like you move through. Like, you know, he used to cite the Velvet Underground as his favorite band.
Well,
the
way he did this is something I still use, is what the way he sang on my record. And I do this all the time now, too, when people ask me to, like, guest on their things.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. No mic. Like, just make sure the mic is on and recording.
Yeah.
And then my first instinct is what we're going to record.
Uh-huh.
And that's what he did.
Oh, really?
And it's great. That's a great technique because you just trick yourself into doing something pretty cool that you would not.
And then you don't second guess it.
Yeah. And then you can develop it, of course. But sometimes.
What? You mean develop it on the board?
Well, develop the idea.
Oh, yeah. You're saying, so you go with instinct first, and then you're like, we nailed something with that, but let's work it.
Maybe it's magical, and you don't need to do anything to it.
I just like the way he layers sound.
Yeah.
And like, you know, and he's got like, there's, and I hear that in you, but it's weird. I hear some of that layering, but I also hear Bruce Springsteen in your shit sometimes.
Yeah.
I don't know
that's
why.
That's cool. Yeah, I'll take that.
There's something like earnest and like, you know, like, you know, this song means business.
Right.
And I'm telling a story.
Yeah. It's a tough line, the earnest versus not, because it's funny because I've been like in the studio the last like three, my garage is also the studio.
Sure. You can call it.
Like, can I call it whatever I want?
Yeah.
I've been in the studio.
Yeah. And then I just go over to my bed.
AKA the bed.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because it was this Trump song I'm working on. And just that whole thing about earnestness versus not.
Yeah.
You know, because something can be pedantic or, you know.
Yeah. But what happens? So you get this deal. Like, this is what's interesting to me is that, you know, you got this gig.
Right.
You got the deal on a set of acoustic songs.
Right.
And that first record is pretty layered and well produced.
Yeah, yeah.
So you are now at school almost.
I was at school. That's exactly right, man.
Yeah.
And it was the strangest school for me because my whole philosophy was, you know, is the sort of like, well, you got the first thought, best thought, and then Leonard Cohen says second thought, best thought, or at least that's been attributed to him.
Right.
Which I think is cool. But, you know, and Peter is this, Peter Gabriel was making these records and taking 5 years, 6 years, and lots of people working on them, you know, 20 different groove ideas for a song. So, like, just this real meticulous way of going about it, this real, like, sort of you know, not that it's not coming from the gut, because Peter is like, you know, a groove person and right. stuff like that. But it is a lot up here, too. So it was just opposite of where I was heading in my own way. I was probably going to be like more just like, let's make a garage record, you right. know, like that.
Sure.
You know, but so then all of a sudden I was like in that world.
Opposite extremes.
Yeah. So I learned a lot.
No Jape.
I learned about Jape the hard way.
But like high end Jape.
That's the name of my autobiography. Jape the hard way.
But this is like some high end Jape, dude.
Yeah, no, it was real high end Jape, and it was great. I mean, it's been a wild journey, you know.
Yeah. You know? Well, I mean, but let's talk about, because like when I look at the arc of like your career and your persistence, like you know, it didn't work out the way it could have at the beginning.
Right. Well, it still hasn't. I mean, when I first found out you're going to have me on your podcast, I thought, is this some part of Make-A-Wish Foundation? Is somebody not telling me something? What's going on here? Like, am I getting the results right after this podcast?
Well, no, but like, you know, you were poised.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's a couple times, like you get the machine grinding up.
Well,
you know,
I mean, the first record, Big City Secrets, I mean, it's a good record, mm-hmm. but what happened?
Well, that came out in France and did. I was big in France.
Yeah,
that's the name of my follow up autobiography.
Sure,
big in France. No,
as opposed to Japan.
Yeah, and then it didn't do anything here. And then I waited around for a while before I could get into the studio again. It used to take years. Like,
was it disappointing?
Oh, yeah. Oh, like, yeah, mind-blowingly disappointing. Like, everything, you know, along the way. But that's, like, that's how you develop into, like, not, you know, that philosophy of not being bitter or whatever. Like, hopefully these things don't destroy you along the way. Hopefully they...
Well, you kept working like I did. Even if you were bitter, it's like, you know...
It's the Andy Warhol thing. Like, keep making stuff, and while everyone says how bad it is, make more stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, that's the attitude.
So God willing, or the mystical dwarves, or the spirits willing, if you ever do hit, people are going to be like, who the fuck is this guy? And you're going to have 20 records there.
Right, and if I don't, like, or to whatever degree I do or don't, it doesn't really matter. I mean, other than, you know, I don't know. That's my attitude sitting here right now on your, like, on Marc Maron's podcast, though. So, I mean, like, there could go a lot further down from here.
But the thing is weird, right? But you still work. I'm sure you've been down, and, like, you know, it seems like there's been booze involved at different times, so you can get real
there's
down.
There's been booze. Yeah, there's been ladies.
Yeah, booze and ladies. That can really take you all the way down. All the way down.
Oh, yeah.
Those are two tickets to the bottom level.
Yeah.
But you know, but even when, you know, after I liked the Lou album,
mm-hmm.
which is just called Lou, the songs right. of Lou Reed.
Then you didn't know a way to get in because there's too much stuff.
Well, no. I mean, I kind of like kicked me and poked around a little right. bit, but I did listen to Days of Surrender a few uh-huh. times.
Oh, cool.
Like
that's interesting, because that was the record I made after Lou, and I kind right. of sort of had that same inspiration. It's funny that you're that.
Well, that came to me in vinyl, and the cover is engaging, and I was sort of intrigued by you in general, because there's something, you know, very unique and very, you know, ethereal about like the way you produce records.
Huh.
So I listened to Days of Surrender with that same kind of intent, like like of like there's something going on here. You know, like this guy's right. doing things.
Yeah.
And I had to listen to it a few times because it's
You were listening to my magical garage. That's what you were listening to. That's uh-huh. that's my magical garage.
It's a lot of layers, dude.
Yeah.
In that record.
In a good way? I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, because you listen to it and then you hear your voice, and then it's sort right. of like, it sounds like there's like a whole other thing going on alongside of it.
Huh.
That's, do you know what I mean?
I,
here's the music, here's a song.
Right.
And like, what's going over there on the right?
You know,
like, there's like
oh, right,
textures
yeah.
and shit.
Yeah. Yeah, lots of panning and stuff like uh-huh. that on the stereo spectrum. I mean, I probably could mix it better now that I've watched my Mixing with Mike videos. I mean, that's the thing.
That was,
it's like, that was pre-mixing with Mike, so I didn't like, you know.
It's not my intention of, making you feel insecure.
No, I appreciate you shouting out that record.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Another, it's all right.
Is there a better way to say that? I appreciate
talking
you mentioning that record, yeah.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know. It's just something I put out and, you know, yeah.
Well, what now, but after...
There's not a lot of hoopla, or there's, you know, it's hard
you put it out by yourself?
Yeah, kind of, yeah. That's the way I mean to
do you have a label?
I do, Lonely Astronaut Records, I guess. I mean, it's like, we just I think it's like this thing where every time you put out something new, it's the music business has changed again. So yeah. It's like you reinvent it again every single time.
How many big labels have you been at?
Oh, man. Well, through Real World, I was on Virgin, and then I went on to Universal.
Real World, what is that?
Real World is Peter Gabriel's label.
Yeah. And you went to Virgin?
And I was signed to Real World, and then they put it out through Virgin. So you get signed, sometimes you get signed to these labels that are also signed to labels.
Right. Subsidiaries.
Subsidiaries.
Now, yeah. The second record, Come to Where I'm From, like, mm-hmm. you
that
know,
was
this.
Produced by T-Bone Burnett.
Who's a genius.
Yeah.
You know, in his own way, right? I mean, I
think so, yeah.
I liked a couple of his solo records, and, you know, certainly he's a great archivist.
Oh, he's.
And what did he bring?
The world is a better place for T-Bone.
Yeah, and what did he bring to your sound?
You know, he produced me, he gave me so much confidence. It's hard to explain. I don't think it's any accident that he keeps having big success that he does, because I don't know. There was something he did where he just like made me feel like what I was doing was very important, and just gave me a lot of confidence. And then we made that at Sound City, which was the documentary.
Another magic place.
Which is a magic place, yeah.
Yeah.
And just the whole thing. And that was like the LA record. I was out in LA for like 3 months staying at the Oakwoods. I found Usher's driver's license in the parking lot. And I turned it in.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so yeah.
And how'd that record do?
Well, that record actually sort of was kind of like, is considered my first record over here in a way. And that did pretty, I got Record of the Year in Entertainment Weekly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it had and it was a critically well-received record, and it sold okay.
Yeah.
But it didn't sell a lot, you know, and so Virgin kind of lost interest after that, and then that's when I went to Universal.
It's got the groovy cover, too. You always got good covers.
Thanks, man. I usually paint them. I'm a painter.
Yeah?
Yeah.
When did that start?
Oh, that's painting. I've been painting since I was a kid.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And you do all your covers?
Yeah.
Mostly, right?
Usually, yeah. Pretty much.
And so, like, so then, all right, so they didn't pan out as well as Virgin wanted it to?
Yeah.
And then you go to Universal?
Then I went to Universal, and, that was Honey in the Moon, which went on the OC, and that did okay.
Yeah.
It was a song I have called Honey in the Moon.
Yeah. And that was from Redemption Sun?
Redemption Sun.
How'd the record do in general?
It did a little better, but still, you know, nothing that's going to, like, excite.
Well, but are you really writing songs that, you know, are hook-laden and I mean, it seems like you were sort of a little... It wasn't even that you were... It's not even an alt sound. It's a very unique sound.
Yeah.
That you know, I don't know. I mean, were you writing songs to be huge?
I mean, in my mind, I like, write what I like, you know? And so it's just...
That's all you can do.
I like good songs and I like hits, you know. So I'm trying to write songs that are likable. It's not, you know, but I'm also not like following a formula or something like that. I'm coming from my own unconsciousness.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So that
record. And Peter like specifically said that to me a few times, which was, don't go to them. Let them come to you.
Well, there is a dreamlike quality to some of it, like especially on Days of Surrender, which you did in your garage without the help of Mike.
Yeah.
Was that there is a sort of frequency to it that feels a little dreamy.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that, I mean, it vibrates on that level somehow, because I think that's what I engage with. Like, you know.
You like that dreamy level.
Well I just like, I saw it as something unique.
Right.
You know, and I felt
that's
it.
Cool.
Like, I felt like, you know, like this guy's is a real thing. He's his own thing.
Wow, thank you so much. That means a lot to me. Seriously.
But then you go on, like from between Redemption Sun and The Ballad of Boogie Christ, mm-hmm. which was some sort of mildly subverted personal story.
Which, oh, yeah. I like the way you said that. Mildly subverted.
Personal story. But I mean, you did like four records.
Uh-huh.
Five records even.
Yeah.
You just keep pushing them out.
I keep making records. I love making records.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't love showbiz so much. I mean,
preaching to the choir.
Yeah, but like this is nice.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't showbiz, but you know what I mean? Like,
But throughout these records, are you still working with Keltner? Like when you do
sometimes,
Our Shadows Will Remain.
Fistful of Mercy, my band with Ben Harper and Danny Harrison, Jim played on that too.
what was the arc of learning, you know, from, you know, through after Universal, where do you go? Who does Our Shadows Will Remain?
Okay, so Our Shadows Will Remain, yeah, it's interesting, was this label called Vector.
Yeah.
And that's and they're a huge management company still now. And they got me onto this label in England called 14th Floor Records.
Uh-huh.
And 14th Floor was doing like David Gray and Damien Rice, mm-hmm. and selling like millions. And so right. they were slotting me into that. And I they geared it up. They did do a really good job with Our Shadows Will Remain. I sold out like Shepherd's Bush Empire over there. Like it was building and doing really well. But then there was like something happened. Like they were going to go with Honey in the Moon. They were going to try to like repurpose an old song for yeah. a single. They thought that was, they were going to yeah. try to take it to the mountaintop.
Yeah.
Didn't work.
Yeah.
It didn't fly on radio. And then all of a sudden, that's it. It just starts. It's a fadeaway. But when you see the fadeaway coming, and then you know it's there, and then it's like
again.
There's the fadeaway. Okay.
And that's when you got your own label going, or your own outlet.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, yeah, I don't mean to be so vague about that. I just don't know what that even means. It's like,
yeah, maybe I don't either.
Yeah, like I don't like a label now.
But you started self-producing.
Yeah, or just being able, like, getting distribution.
Right.
You know,
right?
But I mean, even that, my own label was through Megaforce, which is a big, huge label. You know, so that's why I always go like, "Do I have my own label?" Kind of. You know.
Well, it sounds like you got a lot of support through musicians and some producers. Yeah. Like, are you self-producing? Like, who produced Nuclear Daydream?
I think yeah, I did.
Yeah,
yeah.
And you know, you just sort of took hold of that shit.
Yeah, and then that was because that's when the Our Shadows Will Remain fade started happening.
Yeah,
and I had Nuclear Daydream. When I review my history, I look at the albums I followed up, like getting a little bit of vibe going.
Yeah,
and go, okay, did I let myself down? And I really don't feel like I did. Like I feel like no, that record stands too. Like
yeah.
You know, it's just that I don't really follow a particular sound or style. I think a lot of people, like, to me, styles of music are kind of like the outfit you're wearing versus the outfit I'm wearing or something. Or just
I
like,
guess,
you know,
but I hear you throughout. Like, if I got poke
okay.
around.
Okay, cool.
Like, I don't listen to something you've done if I'm, you know, flipping around from and different go, years this? And go, yeah. like, who's this guy?
Yeah, it holds together, I guess.
I think so. The tone yeah. of your songwriting and the way you sing and certainly some of the instrumentation.
Right.
It's not like all of a sudden you're doing a fusion record.
Right. That's next.
Getting back to fusion. Just, it's time.
It's just me on the cover. It's called Just Japing Around.
A lot of slap bass.
Back cover is just a big thing of my thumb hitting a bass string.
Yeah. But like, tell me about the process of making the Ballad of Boogie Cries, because that sounds interesting.
Yeah, that was a long, that was word first. I normally wrote songs, like Days of Surrender, for instance,
yeah.
is all melodically driven.
Right.
It's all just like, so I'm just making up words to fit into the melodies, you know?
Uh-huh.
And with Boogie Christ, I had like words first.
So which is why you got this story arc in a
kinda,
way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's it with that. And then, I mean, that just took years and years to make. Just like, but you let it go. You know, like you work on it for a while, and then you like walk away and do other things, and then you work on it again.
How'd you fund it?
Oh, through Pledge Music.
And that was before Kickstarter.
That was after Kickstarter, but yeah, Pledge Music, and yeah, that really worked out pretty well for us.
Yeah?
Yeah, it was good.
It's
a lot of work. I mean, the thing is that it's perceived as like this... you know, you're kind of your hands outreached, which I guess it is. But in the end, you're really just selling your stuff. It's like a fire sale for your merch
right.
store, I guess.
Yeah,
on,
yeah.
on some level. I
yeah.
mean, you know.
But you got enough bread together and you got good players on that thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And
you work with Garth Hudson?
Garth Hudson came. I mean, it was going to originally just be like, yeah, just me and Garth.
On one of the big sounding organs?
Well, there's this studio called Old Soul.
Yeah.
In upstate New York, and Garth lives there.
Yeah.
And not at the studio, but so, and Garth would come, and Garth would come by around like midnight.
Mm-hmm.
He works late,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
And just, he, talk about a magical being, you know? And just, he's like, kind of leans like this, and,
yeah.
and just starts doing things, and it's just like playing a Casio keyboard up here that's just got little mini keys,
yeah.
and he somehow like, playing something amazing, and then playing a grand piano with with the other hand, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know,
that's cool to work with that guy. Huh?
Yeah, that was unbelievable. It really was. And he doesn't say much in between, but then he listens and he makes sure you erase things he doesn't like.
Oh, yeah.
Because he doesn't want them getting out there.
Yeah. We're controlling the, you know, didn't want no jape out there.
Didn't want the jape. Man, this jape word landed for you. This is going to.
Well, you pushed it. You sold it to me.
You're going to use jape.
So did you, like, tell me about, like, it was sort of like there. I read some stuff on you, and it seemed like sort of an ironic. But
I read some stuff on you.
But there was sort of touching to me that, like, you got a Grammy nomination for a cover.
Oh, God, you love it.
Like, I'm like, this guy's been working his whole life on his music.
You know what I'm glad? I'm glad you see the humor in it, because that's the big, that's how you survive it.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny as hell. It really is. You know, I think, you know.
Which cover was it?
Called Vacancy, yeah.
How many years in for when you do Vacancy?
That was still early days.
Oh.
So that was like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that wasn't quite as hysterical as it's becoming.
Right. Oh, it was an EP too.
Yeah, and it's an EP, yeah.
Yeah. You got a little attention from the industry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
Do you ever do art for other people?
I've been asked a couple times. Yeah. I haven't really done it much, but...
But you do a lot of painting, and have you sold your paintings?
Oh, yeah. I paint all the time and do art shows and stuff like that. That really helps me...
You have a gallery?
Keep the living going, too.
Or do you just sell them online?
I used to have a gallery called Museum of Modern Arthur.
Yeah.
I opened up in Dumbo, Brooklyn.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, for like 3 years. We had like events, and it was pretty fun.
Did it work out?
It did to the, you know, I didn't get rich, but yeah. I mean, it depends on your definition of working out.
Was it a scene?
It was a little bit of a scene. It was fun.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
And they just sent me today, this morning, your book of poetry, so you got that.
Yeah, I write poems and post them.
But do you write them to, not to be songs, but just to be poems?
I write a lot, so, you know, and then I just post them and, you know, I don't know, some of them I think are, you know, they're as cheesy as they want to be, you know.
Just putting shit out in the world, man.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's like I'm driven to do it.
But this new album, the new album Family, again, is another album that sort of explores, you know, themes throughout characters.
Right.
And this does sound a little different to me.
Right.
In that, well, you know, well, I mean, the piano is very prominent.
I wrote it all on piano. I got this Steinway Vertigran from 1912.
Uh-huh.
It was in one family. It came from Connecticut. And it was, I think I got it for like $1,600. In fact, you know, that's something you could, because you don't need a huge space at all for it. I mean, a Vertigran, it's a upright piano.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can get them pretty inexpensively. And this one is like magical. And so I just, I started writing songs on it. And
Was it based on the piano?
It was all based.
Was it with one family? Was there a root?
The root to the story was I was with this girl who was on speed, and her husband or her ex-husband kept calling her and was like upset about her not taking care of the kids, and she was telling me about that, and then I was identifying with him, thinking like, and then when I went home I started writing a song from his perspective to her. You know, and that's called You Wear Me Out on the Family. Mm-hmm. And that was the seed of the whole record. And then from there, I just decided, okay, I could write a whole album on just family dynamics.
Yeah.
And so I started talking to my own, like my own family about their histories and stuff. And I started like using aspects of my grandparents and just a way to explore my own sort of family history as well. But even though it's not about my
was it cathartic for you?
I think all creative acts are cathartic, you know, like there is some sort of catharsis there. I mean, I think like, you know, we're given all this energy to do something with. And if I don't do something creative with mine, I do something destructive, you know? I'm not so results based. That's maybe one of the problems.
But it sounds like on some level you create to save your life.
That's why I do it. That's why I don't have a problem with whatever the universe wants. Wherever the universe wants to put me in that mix is cool with me, because it sounds cheesy, but it's really true. The reward is in doing it.
Yeah.
You know, I just like doing it, you know?
And how much did you spend a lot of time with Lou?
You know,
were you around when he was sick?
I did see him a lot, you know, for a time there, you know.
Yeah.
Did
you learn from him?
I did, yeah. I mean, it's hard to put into words exactly, you know, because I learned from his music so much before, you know. But just with him, I just, you know, just loved him as a person, you know, and tried to not ask too many, you know, questions about, tried to not be a fan. And I kind of wish in a way that I had been more of a fan or more asked more just like,
fan questions.
Hey, what's, you know, that Coney Island, that guitar sound on Coney Island Baby. Like, you know what I mean? Like, but I did text him once that Coney Island Baby is the best song that anyone's ever written.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he handled it very graciously. Then I immediately said, oh, sorry to fan out. And he wrote something nice back.
Like, oh, he did?
Yeah, he wrote something very nice back, you know. So he was a nice guy.
Yeah.
That's the thing. He was really... Inside, he was a very nice guy. I mean, and outside, but like, you know what I mean? He has the...
Sure. Well, I mean, like anybody else, you know, you don't know who they are until they let you in.
Yeah.
And if they let you in, then you know.
Yeah.
And if they know that you already know, they usually let you in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You know? I think that's true. What did your folks do when you were growing up?
My dad was... he was building truck tires and he worked for the government. Then he put himself through law school.
Oh, yeah.
And then he became a lawyer. And he also built like houses. I mean, he worked really, really hard.
Is he still around?
Still around, yeah. And I don't know what strata you would put us in.
Well, I mean,
lower middle class, middle class. Like, I don't know.
How does he feel about you?
Well, that's probably complicated, but,
I mean, like, you know, is he proud? Does he like your work? Does he?
I think so.
Oh, that's good.
I think so. Yeah. We have a good, I feel like my family relationship is good, you know?
Good.
I mean, you know, we're a dramatic bunch. I mean, we, you know, we're crazy.
But usually they just want to know you're okay. And
I think they really care about me. They really love me, and I really love them and care about them too, you know?
And your mom's all right?
And my mom's really good. Yeah. Yeah,
good.
They're together still.
Up in Ohio?
Yeah, in Akron. They still live in the house that I grew up in. Yeah.
So you go back there
sometimes? Back. I sleep in my childhood bedroom. But now it looks like a Pier 1 Imports instead of the cool bedroom I left it. With Jimi Hendrix posters on the wall.
Where'd they put the posters, man? Where are the posters, man?
Yeah.
You want to play a song?
Sure.
On my guitar?
Why not?
Is that in tune?
The drunk, I miss the fiend, I miss the simplicity of addiction in the scene. I miss wandering aimlessly in half-dead sewers with rats for eyes, chewing on forgiveness and the will to apologize. I miss the return and no return as I burn in avalanches of white snow and yellow cocaine. I miss talking to brick walls while following the grain and human dolls as I plagiarize myself like a dummy, stuffed with counterfeit money for Cairo and black honey. I miss illusions begging to be chased, even as they disappear into me erased. Until there is no one or nothing but the chase, and a powdery ghost with no face or faith, and the woman of my dreams disappearing without grace. I miss the zoo. I miss the zoo. I miss the zoo. Evolving into a cloud of blue marijuana, blown from the lips of hookers and pimps as they shake each other down in the alleys for the damn but mighty. No one but the weak around and the beautiful unsightly. I miss numb Neanderthals marching in rows of living dead, from my wisdom teeth to Spain and back again in my head.
I miss salvation in syringes and angels of mercy and blooms of smoke numbing rain which drinks when thirsty. I miss glasses full of spirits without tongues speak to me of Napoleon's wild nights. I miss staying up for days and becoming a psychic pretzel flying kites. Chewed on by a Zulu heading with toads to Mars. A mysterious prison and one without bars. At least those kind of bars. I miss the zoo. I miss the zoo. I miss the zoo. I miss waking in the arms of strangers like puppies just born in the pound to a dead mother with eyes sealed shut, looking for a tit to suck and other dangers. When the night before laughter was our only pursuit, even as knives carved up our backs and demons sat like Buddhas eating fruit, meditating on hate forever in our minds. I miss exposing even my bones and the need that rewinds, even my burning home, even my gutted inner child, even my dead grandfather beneath the ground that's wild, even my criminal family, even my weed whacker thoughts whipping a thin plastic string to cut the ears off others as I sing. I miss Van Gogh's revenge, I miss his nightly binge, I miss spiders surrounding my bed and lifting me as if an effigy or a dead king, a prophet of doom, a Jesus for the apocalypse wearing dirt like perfume, or a mother for Satan, or a ghost for all the children of abuse. Take me into the fire, watch me burn like a goose as they sing in spider voices. There goes creation, there goes the moon, there goes the butterfly wanting a cocoon. I miss being a bloom and a goon, waking up too soon in the afternoon. I miss the zoo. The zoo. I miss the zoo.
That was great, man.
Thanks.
They got it. I love it, man.
Thank you so much.
Great talking to you.
You too, Mark. I really, I'm a big fan. I think what you do is wonderful, and thank you for doing it.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I like talking to you.
Thank you, Mark.
Nice, right? I like when people play in here. So I'm going to leave it at that. I guess I won't be playing because we just had a guy play and sing, right? WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Posters, t-shirts, tour dates. Blog, podcast. Whew. Yeah, I'm sweating. Boomer lives! Hey folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.